Good evening and welcome to episode 4 of the Norton Hales Cricket Club podcast. This evening I'm joined by a very special person myself. Growing up, this gentleman was one of the most poignant figures in my teenage years. Best friend, rival, teammate. And as life goes on, you sort of lose contact, but obviously reaching out just to try and get a different point of view on what cricketers look for within a cricket club and what cricket clubs look like from the outside looking in, trying to get a different perspective of what makes club cricket so special to everybody involved. So, ladies and gentlemen, please give me a massive welcome to my special guest, Mr. Andy Bowers. Andy, how are you?
I'm good, sir. How are you, mate? Good to meet you,
and you, mate? Yeah, very good, very good. I can't complain. It's all good. Everybody's sort of raving about the podcasts and different things and getting different invites to come and do the podcast in certain places and just mix it up for close season, really, just to try and bring the cricket club into the sort of digital 21st century. And how about yourself? Obviously, I haven't spoken to you properly for a long, long time. Obviously, last time I did any sort of cricket with or against you was when you were over at Stone. And I know you've been Aldridge and a few other places since.
Yeah, Stone was 2007, and then I moved back down to Aldridge until 2014.
Okay.
So yeah, and then I've been at all the contingent then. So yeah, it's been a good, you know, 8-9 years ago.
Okay, brilliant.
10 years ago, yeah.
Well, just to add a little bit of context to tonight's podcast. Basically, Andy grew up just at the top of my street, and we've always said that if our road was ever to produce a cricket team, it would probably be one of the greatest league cricket sides around, with the Mallard brothers, myself, Mike, Chris, yourself, Sean, Ben Grange at the bottom of the street. So there's definitely been a little bit of cricketing heritage, and we forgot the Dodds as well, obviously. We could definitely have had a full team there, even with Stuart doing the cricket management and all that sort of stuff there. So
yeah.
Myself,
Reddy, because he's shit to be in those spaces.
Who's that?
I think my big brother is in those spaces.
Sean?
Oh yeah, he's awesome.
He was pointless on a Saturday, mate, because if he bowls that line and left, nobody could hit it, and he was never going to get anybody else. So it was just,
you've got to
play to your strengths, haven't you? It's no point bowling too well.
you want to
bowl a bit like me, short, halfway down, and let it sky in the air and get the other one out by a few. So obviously from that, so adding from that sort of context, myself and Andy grew up fairly close together. Andy grew up at Hemheath, where he sort of late great father was the groundsman, and obviously we'll touch on Bomber a little bit later on. And then in 1999, Andy convinced me to have half a season at Hemheath, which didn't particularly go my way. And looking back,
1999 was it then? Was it really?
I think so. Yeah, I'm thinking. Wow. I was trying to do some research onto it, because I'm sure I signed. No, hang on, really before that, 97, maybe 98. Because I'm sure I signed as pro at Wedgwood in 2000, 2001. So yeah, around that
possible,
sort of area.
Yeah.
And then since then, obviously adulthood happens and different things like that. Family sort of happened on there. So we've got a long-standing sort of background. So. As we said before we came on air, we wanted to talk about what cricketers look for within a club. Obviously, between us, we probably had more clubs than Ian Woosnam. So it was kind of trying.
Not possible.
Well, he's one too many, as they say. And what I wanted to try and look at was what makes cricket clubs appealing. Because obviously, we're getting to that stage of the year now, where Christmas is approaching, and then there's usually that mad dash of sort of 7 or 8 weeks before the transfer deadline hits at the end of February, where clubs are clambering around, and then you've got the last minute moves and sort of looking at sort of what's appealing. And I think the nutshell from my point of view is, when you're looking at it from a cricket club point of view, is from a player. I mean, I used to get massively hyped up about the politics and getting overly hyped and overly stressed over certain things that didn't necessarily matter. And as I've gone into sort of my mid to late 30s, having lost a love for the game, really felt a love with it. And if anybody knew me growing up, that was almost seemed like hard to happen.
But, yeah, definitely.
I mean, falling out of love with the game, I think the biggest thing I look at now is when you strip it all back, and yes, clubs do need people that are very selfless, dedicated volunteers, but For me, it's just about being able to turn up, having a bat or a bowl, the thing that you're good at, and obviously just getting used to that sort of team ethos, really. So, I mean, you saying that you moved to Witherden, where you are at the moment, you changed that in 2014. Yes. What prompted that sort of move? What were you looking for at the time?
I was playing once most of my life. I was getting injured more, and I found that the direction they were taking, although I loved that club, it wasn't for me, really. I'd like you, I've lost a little bit of love of it. I found that I'd done everything I needed to do in the ones, and I just played for a different reason. Now, I don't really enjoy batting anymore. I certainly don't enjoy keeping. So I played for a bit of camaraderie, really, and I moved to Lichfield, and Whittington's much more local.
Yeah.
It's a village club, much like Norton Ales. It's a tiny little village outside Lichfield. It's got very few people in the village itself, really. I think it's 3,000, I think, has been Whittington. And it just seemed like a place where I can go and get a pint after the game, enjoy a bit of cricket without getting verbally abused to the high end like you do nowadays, I think, at the ones level. And I could just, have a bit of fun, a bit of camaraderie, really. But I know that I'm unusual that way. I think the game's changed, doesn't it? People don't play for that reason anymore. But that was the reason I went to Whittington, just get a bit of fun back into the game, really. A bit like you when you lost your love for it.
I think back and I look at individuals that play for Norton, I look at, I'll use my brother, for example. He's disappeared to Australia to get a little bit of a winter of cricket and different things like that. But when I look back at what I was like at Chris's age, at sort of 23, 24, and I was probably massively exuberant. I'm trying to think where I was at that age. I would have probably been Leek, just starting at all stage of that age. And I think you look for different things, don't you, at certain times. I know Chris is constantly craving for the ball and he wants to do well and he's a little bit over-exuberant and different things like that at times. And it's just, when you look at it, it's like, I suppose you go through stages. And I think, when I look back now, and I remember going back to the days where you used to come against, like, the Paul Shaws at Cheadle, and you play against people like Tony Dutton of old. Obviously, he's still playing. I played against Tony last year. And you think to yourself, they're a lot more laid back, whereas with sort of full gusto, full rah 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 in your face. And it's one of those things where I'm looking at it now and thinking there aren't as many characters in the games. But then,
I agree.
I think it's just where that line is. I know obviously there's the ECB rules and regulations, and now obviously cap, level one bans, level two bans, all that sort of stuff. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, everybody will be looking at going into clubs now. And if you were a club now looking to sort of recruit players, what would you say would be your main priorities or main things you'd be looking to sort of show off and offer a player as a?
Certainly, as I skip at the seconds that I've put with. One of the things I'm big on is team atmosphere. Really, I think a lot of us work in jobs and go to college and things and uni. And I play cricket now to have a bit of fun. So I always look for people who will give me something back in regards to team atmosphere. Someone who can have a laugh. Someone to have great camaraderie with. Someone I enjoy spending time with. And on the other side of the coin, you want someone who can win your game of cricket as well. Because even though we've lost the love for the game, you still want to win deep down, really. Even you say you don't sometimes, but sometimes you still get pissed off when you lose a game, don't you? When you shouldn't lose one. So somebody who can win you a game, someone you enjoy spending time with, really. Sadly, I think the modern way for clubs now is, especially players, like clubs, is how much money you can pay. And I think it's been going on for as long as we've been around. It'll carry on going on. But I also think it's quite sad, isn't it, really? The first question you ask is, how much are you going to pay me? I think it's quite sad.
I argue with myself a lot about this argument. Now, obviously, like I said, the argument's been going on much longer before, since we came along, and it will definitely be going on for much longer once we've gone. And one of the biggest things that I get frustrated with is not so much the fact that people get paid, it's just people that probably aren't worth getting paid.
People are good enough to get paid, though, isn't it? I don't mind people getting paid or a little bit of petrol money if they are good enough. But let's be honest, though, there's people getting paid when we were an hour youth, they wouldn't. You wouldn't even get picked, never mind getting paid.
Well,
in fairness.
I'm going to refrain from that because people would definitely argue that I got paid when I shouldn't have done at Wedgwood, but I was actually just part and parcel of how it was. But it's at the time, it was just one of those things where everybody's looking around. I think it becomes a desperation thing. You were saying after Christmas, everybody's like, oh, we need this to stay competitive. Yeah. And I know a lot of people pointed at, I'm trying to think when it was, 01 or 02 when the league went open from the old North South Cheshire to North Staffordshire district. That Div 1, and then obviously you were part of that Hemeath setup just at that cliche move into that time. And I suppose that's when the gears kicked in for a lot of clubs, where the desperation and the recognition that, hang on a minute, we need to be part of something.
Yeah, you should prove. Anyway. Yeah, of course you do. Yeah, and I get that. I'm not against that at all. I just think the first thing nowadays that players will look for is money. Whereas in there used to be, can you win something? What's the atmosphere like? What's the camaraderie like? And, you know, but now I think the first thing they ask for is money. You know, it's a modern way, isn't it, really? It is what it is.
Well, going back to when we spoke to Longy, I think one of the biggest things that Longy admitted to was it comes back to the challenge, isn't it, really? And I think clubs have also got to be very, you know, even though I've sort of changed my outlook on the game, I'm still very much competitive. Losing sucks to the point where
you're
going in a bad mood. But that's just a red-blooded competitive male. I have to be nice to everybody all day of the week, and I still play that game of cricket where I can vent, I can be that sort of stuff. I mean, I don't say boot to a goose anymore, but I think it's just one of those things where you still need to have that ambition and making sure that if you've got a wide span of ages that you've been able to show that ambition, but at the same time having that best of both, really.
I think
from a Norton point of view, obviously, some of the events that we have off the field are quite prominent, obviously, with the, you know, like the likes of the union with Matthew Hoggard, side bottom, that sort of stuff, and then the connections we've got with Giles at the Red Lion and things like that. It's definitely something that we're trying to work on. And I think it's just one of those things. I'm trying to think, Simon Dyer at 25, what would I be looking for at the club? Because I know exactly what I look for at 37, but I'll look back at now and think, what would a 21 to 25-year-old Simon Dyer look at? And given the way that the game's changed, I mean, you're pretty much the same age as me, so I'm thinking, what would you look at? If you were that age, going back to how exuberant and how, let's be honest,
we were both
a pair of badges.
Looking back at 25, 26, I was looking for the standard. Is it a good standard? You know, if you're going to play cricket, you know, it's a long day cricket, so if you're going to play, you want to test yourself a little bit, you want to play well. Are we a good side? Can we win something realistically, or can we at least compete for something? Mm-hmm. And then, again, the bigger one for me is, what's the camaraderie like? You know, what's the atmosphere in the club like? Has it got an infrastructure? Has it got a youth academy? You know, do they want to try and progress and do things? I think as a 25-year-old, you know, I wouldn't say you peak, but you know, you're turning toes to, aren't you, really? And that, you just want to keep pushing, you know. So you want a club that you think is going to benefit you. Looking at 25, or like I say, at 37, 38, you're looking slightly different now. But at 25, I think you knew probably pretty similar that way. I'm thinking, anyway.
Well, yeah, I think it's one of the things, like, because one of the biggest things you've touched on there is it's a massive investment in time. And especially. I mean, obviously you've got a young family now as well, and obviously you've got Liz. So you've got to factor in their wants and needs as well, haven't you? To factor in with everything that's going on. So I think one of the biggest things that a younger person obviously might take into consideration would be, you know, off the field. I mean, Longy was talking about the 2002 Prem winning team, and he was saying one of the biggest things was the off the field stuff. They were a team, and if you weren't staying for a beer after and having all those sort of things, that you would be considered, I suppose, a little bit odd, really. And like you say, it's so many games now, and I don't really think that happens.
You can traditionally stay for a pint, at least long at the end of the game. You know, you shake your hands, don't you, and you have a pint, don't you? Like you say, now you're lucky you stay for a token and go, really.
I think I'm not sure. I'm trying to think. I mean, I'm trying to think. The last time I didn't stay for a beer at the game, whether at home or away, was I don't think. But in fact, I can't think. But you see, so many clubs now that I don't know if it's part of society or a bit of that bad bloodness that, oh, stuff this, we're not staying here for one, lads, or, you know, especially if you perceive to be on the bad end of a result or a bit of bad blood between things, it just seems to, that element of class in the game. We don't know, I've had some absolute barnies, and you think back to the Hemi side of the late 90s that you had floating around with
Sanders, Bengers.
Yeah, exactly.
I love Mark. I mean, I'm genuinely affectionate for Mark. But, you know, what he's like on the pitch is completely different to off it. But you couldn't play with or against Mark without having a Barney. It just didn't happen.
I think that's just one of them that, like, I think that's the thing, like, white line fever. I still sort of get it to the point where I don't shout and scream. I just end up moaning at my brother. But I think it's just one of them that's... I'm not sure if that's a disconnect of society or just an accident.
I think that's something new. I think that's a personal thing, personally. We all want to, you know, a lot of us at baseball want to win. I think just one of those things that you're just ultra competitive, aren't you? You need to come out in different ways, I thought.
Well, yeah, I think it's just one of them where you think back and you think back to, I'm trying to think of an example that we would have shared. I think, in fact, I'll pick one. You were at Fenton,
yeah.
At the same time, me, Chris, and Mal at Wedgwood.
2002, that was, I remember that.
2002, so we were fiercely competitive, yet at the same time, best of friends. And I know we'd had words on the field, but it's one of them that you think back, that's kind of, it's all building on. That's the sort of heat of the mountain. You know, you're under pressure to achieve because Fenton had put that, press something in. The same for me and Chris at the same time. And it's one of those things where... That's why we play sport. You play sport to escape what is the norm and everything else, but at the same time, you've got to be able to go in the bar and have a pint with Farm and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I remember that year, 2002, because that was the year of signing for Fenton. I was praying for him, rightly or wrongly, probably wrongly. And we actually drew Hemis in the cup. And I remember playing against them at the Fenton ground on a Sunday. And there was a lot of people there, red hot day. I remember batting. The Ridges dropped me mid off dolly on about 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. I ended up getting 60 odd, but I remember my brother, Sino, Akko, just quite rightly give me a lot of grief for the best part of 30 overs. Me thinking, well, I'm gonna grow up with you lads here, and I still consider them my best friends. And as soon as the game's finished, you have a pint or five, you shake their hands, and you reminisce about the old times, and I think that's a really positive thing about cricket sometimes, that does give you that ability to do that. I just said about all the rivalries, we had it, and then, okay, I'm going on it down the line.
Well, I think it goes back to, I speak to Ballas last week, I mean, it comes back to what makes, in my eyes, cricket different to probably every other sport on the planet, because even though it's a team game, there is that very much, you're out there on your own, that individualistic sort of 1 versus 11 or 2 versus 11 or 11 against 2, whichever way you want to look at it. And it's the team's job to do pretty much everything they can within the laws of the game to decarb, or I suppose mentally break you down, break your concentration, because batting is all about rhythm, concentration, stamina and strength of mind. And I was having this conversation with Philip White, actually. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when I was talking to Longy, was... There seems to be, especially with a lot of people that are officiating in the game, I'm not going to say umpires because it's unfair and I think the guys do a great job, but there seems to be a lack of disconnect in that thing, because there's so many things that can be said that's a little bit of, you know, banter, repartee, humour, that sort of stuff, because you'll find some of the wittiest minds ever in sort of the cricket field. But then... I think a lot of people get frustrated in the game now because you can't, there needs to be a line, and you know, there's certain things I've heard both in my team and against us that just shouldn't be said over the last couple of years. But I just think that, I remember playing against like Lord Stafford and Pitford Herbert, and you would literally, it's a different level of banter. Like, even though it probably wasn't Efren and Jeffrey, it was probably... You know, I was an 18-year-old lad, and now I still have to Google half the words, and you think about it, there's probably some of the most highly insulting words anybody could ever have said, but it's just one of those things that you take that, and it's just that's just building strength of character and strength of thing. But at the same time, as you say, you go off the field, you shake hands, you do whatever you need to, really. And I think, you know, as much as the game's moved forward from a, you know, it's scary how some of the young kids are that are playing for England on the international stage in the county scene, but that historic sort of club, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not sorority, but kind of like a male sort of group, sort of gentleman's club sort of style, sort of banter and get together, that sort of thing seems to have, I don't know, eroded throughout the game. I'm not sure if it has eroded or is definitely on a way of eroding it. Your thoughts on that?
I agree with you. I think certainly when we were younger in the 20s, used to play cricket all day and drink all night. And there's a lot of times, especially at Henry's and Aldi's as well, where you were leaving the club at 2, 3 in the morning, getting up and playing on the Sunday, and then going to work on the Monday. And I think nowadays, time just changes, you know, time goes on, doesn't it? All time, things evolve. But I do think it's a different approach now, a different game now. Things are getting more professional, aren't they, in fairness? You know, we just thought our team be getting better coaching, better players, better standards all the time. And just things do change. It's life, isn't it?
Well, you look at the facilities everywhere now, and, you know, even clubs like Blythe, who are in the same sort of ethos when we're playing against Grimmers when, I think back to, I reckon my second game was against sort of Simon Owen and Grimmers for Emmett on an absolute wet, horrible, it was horrible. And I don't even think the game finished, we played about 17, 18 only, but straight away Grimmers even was batting, was giving earache to the bowlers. And you look at where Blythe's facilities are now to where it was that in that ilk, I think right across the plethora of grounds, I think the standards, the thing that the ECB have done, I know people rightly and wrongly, I mean, we've got good friends links with people who play in the Shropshire setup that isn't an ECB affiliation, and they're moaning about obviously how strict some of the ECB pyramid rules are. But if you look at what that's done for clubs across the land in terms of standards, facilities, rightly or wrongly, rules, I mean, you look, it's changed the landscape of league cricket. You look at where Hemheath are now, they wouldn't have been
Without that structure. If you remember Hemheath from when we were young, I love that place dearly. It's got special memories for me, and I think probably more so for my brother. He's recently retired playing there. But from where it was then to how it is now, I mean, it's probably one of the best grounds in Staffordshire. I know it does hold county games. We've had Derbyshire's second team game this year. But a lot of it is down to the ECB a lot of time and funding. But a lot of these clubs are run by the volunteers. Like Norton Hales, isn't it? It's just more club look at it now. Mm-hmm. Without the volunteers in the background, these clubs wouldn't survive.
Really?
I think that it's sad, isn't it? That a lot of people don't get recognition when they should do, but they don't do it for recognition as well. But sometimes you've got to say, well, fair play to you all. Because even Clark Wickington, I love Whittington dearly, but without the volunteers in the background, nothing would get done. Mm-hmm. And it's always the same 5 or 6 people. It's the same with every club you go to. I'm sure Norton's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. But without them, we wouldn't exist, really.
That's the same thing. I mean, every club you go to, they always look at another club and think, oh, we need more people helping out like they've got. But the grass isn't always greener. When you look at it, I've sat on the committee at Allsager, recently come onto the committee at Norton, got heavily involved behind the scenes at Wedgwood when I was back then. I've always tried to sort of give whatever I can. And obviously you don't want to be treading on people's toes, and people do what they need and people got different times. And it's you're quite right, it's that same 5 or 6 people within that, whereas in an ideal world, a committee would be made up of probably 20, 30, 40 people without having too many Chiefs and not enough Indians, because obviously that workload would get done. But I think a lot of people take great pride in the volunteering and the time, and, you know, some might argue that they're lucky with the time that they have to dedicate that, but it's just people do it for the love of the game and for the people that their community, and ultimately that's what it is. Cricket is a community, whether it's be the team, the club that you play for, or the people that you play against, because the time that you spend on the field, and it is that very much community ethos. Obviously, you know, I think a lot of clubs have embraced the opportunities that the ECB have given with this structure. You know, I know going back to sort of when Hemi played on the old working men's club plot. There was that, you know, they wanted to achieve, but there was never really anywhere to go. You won Senior A, and what happened? You started again the year after, and then obviously there's always that massive snobbery of sort of teams looking down from Div 1 that, you know, they couldn't get relegated. And then as soon as that opened up, it just opened up an absolute plethora of opportunity, really. And that's when you really got to see how much and gusto and belief these volunteers had got in what they wanted to try and achieve, whether that be financially, time and different things like that. And I think, was it 01, 02, obviously the foot and mouth thing, I know Longley talked about this, the thing, the, you know, groundsmen at clubs, you know, the weather that we had in the build-up to the season matched with the fact that we had no rain for about 9 weeks plays absolute havoc. And, you know, I don't... You know, a lot of teams moan and get upset about wickets and different things like that. I mean, you played at Stone when Jerry was doing them. You've obviously played at Emmy where, you know, obviously your dad was doing it. And you see just how much effort goes into preparing.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, phenomenal amount of effort, really.
You know, and it is difficult. I mean, I've had two or three this year that, you know, acid rasa running down the hill, bounce it halfway down, doesn't even get off the floor and smash your millstone on the ground. It gets frustrating.
I've got good memories at Norton Hales, but for anyone on about the wickets, because the batsmen and me at that time still like the challenge, so I quite like the feeling of not knowing to go forward, go back. You're never quite trusting it, and then you've always got either overseas or a good quality amateur coming in at you. Like Andy Kenby, you know, he couldn't run away in the best of times, I'm not at Norton Hales. So he just... But you'd never ever blame, I would never ever blame the groundsmen or the volunteers. It is what it is. People try the hardest, aren't they? It just, for me, that's the camera of it, really. Just has to be a game of cricket.
Well, I think, not just that as well, I think you kind of put a bit, I mean, we talked about Jerry, that was the groundsman, so he's obviously gone over to Stafford, and what he's produced there is almost the other end of the spectrum, where you're almost under too much pressure to sort of score. We played there and scored over 300, and I think they got 270 for nine on what was essentially an absolute short front. And if you go back to Stafford 10 years ago, equally that was just as bad. And I think it's one of them that actually, it's the same for all 22 cricketers on the field. If you know that you're going to go forward, and, you know, is cricket a good game where, you know, somebody smashes 250 and then the team block out for 160 for five? What sort of game of cricket is that? I would much rather play in 160 plays, you know, 159 for nine, or somebody knocks them off for six, or you roll them out.
Keeping on comment on that trend thought, just a quick one for you. And in the South Stats League now, where we play in, the first 11 games is normal cricket, win, lose, draw.
Yeah.
And the middle games is win, lose. And you cannot declare in it. So, you know, if you're in the top, normally you bat and you put a big score on. If you don't go for it, you lose. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, just going on that point you just said. Cricket's no fun when you've hit 250 and they're 75 for one of 35 overs. It's just no fun, is it, really? It does promote positive cricket. I think that's a step forward for you.
Well, there's two schools. I think if I wanted to play devil's advocate for that, I would play on the lines of you have luck of the draw on who you're getting at what particular time of the season.
You always play one. How it works out?
Yeah.
You play. You obviously play the team team twice. You play one game normal cricket, one game win lose. Yeah. It always works out that way.
Okay.
Yeah, it's quite good, but only reason I mention it is because your thought is saying, you know, it's no fun seeing someone block the shit out of for 30 overs, is it? Especially as a bowler. You know, you're trying your best, getting them, and just dead anchoring you. It's no fun, really. It's not good.
Well, no, but the point I was making was sometimes bad wickets kind of make for good cricket, if you know what I mean, because it's harder to block out from draw. You know, if you know as well as I do, when you're playing on a sticky one and it's horrible, one's got your name on it, so what, are you going to hang around and fudge, or are you going to go, right, I'm going to play up and out cricket, if it's up, it's off, you know? And, you know, back in the day, there wasn't anybody much better than that. You, I remember you getting 120 off about 15 overs against Sandyford at Hemheath. I think we were rolled out for about 160 off about 45, and you got 110 of them in 18 overs. And what happened at that point, because everybody changed the mentality, and I think we'd bowled them out for 80 or 90 because the deck wasn't that great. And I think, you know, as a club cricketer, you know, I mean, I was quite lucky. I grew up at Longton. You see your little players going up at Modishull, Stone, Little Stoke, you know, good decks. And then what happens is they grow up and they come and play league cricket everywhere else. They start realising that, hang on a minute, you might have to start going a bit forward here against everything you've been taught playing at Clayton. Yeah. You know, how many times have we gone to Clayton together where literally you've got some absolute joker, Craig Lancaster, running off 18 yards, trying to bounce you, and he's like, he thinks it's Curtly Ambrose, you know.
He's only 1 foot one, as long as you still do it.
Exactly. The only person I've ever met that, I just have to bowl it off. If we took him 10 pin bowling, you'd have to bowl off the top of them ramp things you have to have just to get it out.
But it's,
but it's just one of them where training and obviously getting to play cricket on a Saturday afternoon, I think so many people get held up on, you know, the state of the ground and blah, 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 and the cricket. At the end of the day, it's the same for everybody. And don't get me wrong, I do get if there's a wet day, the last thing you want to do is get, stuck in on a wet one. But that's just the game, is it? You play. It's always been that way. It always will be.
If you lose a toss in a game like that, it's up to your skills as a batsman or bowler. And you get tired
of it,
like I say, it's still an individual game at some point, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, look at tactics. I remember growing up, I was used to playing a team where people would always go, right, I'd say, we'll stick them in and we'll knock them off. Whereas I think playing at Allsager, when I was away at Swardeston, back at Norton, the mentality is different. You run in, you put whatever you can on the board, whether that be 89 to 100, 200, and you defend for your lives because scoreboard pressure is a big thing, especially on, you know, you've only got to get one or two early doors and then all of a sudden, you know, it's then over to somebody else to come and counter-attack and things like that, really. And going back to what we were talking about, mental decon, well, basically breaking people down, it's much easier to sort of absorb it first off and then give it 10 times back, because there's nothing worse. I hate it nowadays if we're literally fielding first and we've got two or three gobby ones in our team giving it left, right and centre, and then I'm opening the batting, and then all of a sudden you're like, "Yeah, we're ripping what we sowed, basically." And that's part of the thing. That's the team game of it, isn't it? Really, if you're gonna play it like that. And I think it's just one of those things that when you're developing as a cricketer, that's the difference, I suppose, between second team and first team cricket. I suppose over competitiveness, would that be allowed? Do you think over competitiveness?
I think you can be over-competitive. I think you can be overzealous, and I think you can overstep the mark sometimes. But I don't think there's anything wrong with being over-competitive in the right environment, really. Obviously, I think you pick a game, I wouldn't typically on Sunday if it's a friendly and stuff, but I've got no problem being over-competitive. It's just when they go a step too far, isn't it, really? But that seems to be a modern way, and it's been going on forever, and it'll keep on going on, wouldn't it, really? It's like anything else.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'll go back to one of the... we talked about Beng. He was obviously trying to get himself up for when he was bowling and blah, 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 just to get his juices flowing. And I remember playing against Dave Follett in the 2020 final when he was at Kidsgrove, obviously way past his best. But all Sage was just flat. It was just a front dog deck where you could literally just walk at anybody. Nobody was going to hit in the face. It was just... you walk at anybody and you try and pump it in. Foll was proper getting in at me. I was just saying to him, I haven't done anything yet, mate, just chill out. And he was just like, literally, all I'm trying to do is just pump myself up. It's just, he's trying to get the adrenaline through the system to make him a better athlete. And that comes down to any sport, that fight and that fight or flight situation where, you know, you can run faster, you can sort of, the blood's glowing, the juices flowing in. Some people do perform better on the edge. You know, you look at how many Premier League footballers that, you know, play in the centre midfield, and unless they've got that adrenaline going and they're playing with a little bit of bite in midfield, then, you know, they're a less effective person. I think, you know, that element of the game, I feel, between first team and second team cricketers is more prevalent, really, probably because people want, especially the older generation, people still want that competitive nature. Obviously, you've always got second team as a playground to bring your juniors through, which is probably an easier place to do it. And I think then that was probably the biggest step. That first year we spoke about when I came to head off season at Hemet, I was highly successful at second team level, bearing in mind I was 17 at the time. playing representative cricket, playing Sassenden 19s at 17. That was the biggest shift for me, watching, turning up and playing against Glenmore, Mick Moore, Grimmers, Simon Irwin, all these people that would literally, all they were hell-bent on was making sure that you weren't playing your game to the best because you were engaging in sort of conversation, and me being a cocky 17-year-old would happily engage with whatever conversation was going on the planet. So I think that's one of those
things. Well, am I wrong? I think I remember your first game for Emmys was at Whitmore away. And I think Whitmore had Keith Arterton.
Third game.
One game, sub-pro. Mm-hmm. And I think, I might have got a skew with, I know I've got two details wrong. I think the first two balls he bowled and the day were at him, he hit you in the field. Just one was a slog and one was a decent shot. And then the third ball he blocked. I know Alan Glover was saying to him, oh, you're playing for a draw, right, Keith? And I just remember looking at it in between Chris and South Laughing, thinking, this is a step up now for him, because he's been playing 17 cricket, and I think he just realised it's not all that easy for him. But I think after that, you were spot on. I think you got your head around it. And you just knuckled down, didn't you? I think after that, you realised he was actually decent.
I think it was
that mental strength that you were talking about, that mental to get you over that, isn't it?
I think it's a learning curve. You know, I remember playing in that. That was the third game that was. We were all laughing because he bowled left arm spin for two overs and realised that we'd all got a back leg that bent and arms that hit balls into the field, and then proceeded to try and run in and bowl left arm seam, which wasn't great, which we were happy with. I think we got 170, 180. I got a little bit disillusioned with professionals that day. He ran in, he hit the first two balls to six. First one, I will say, first ball of the innings. You know, I could swing the ball back in the day. Nice little leg swing.
I'm thinking,
he's plumb, I've got him. And then all of a sudden, he's just whipped it. If anybody's ever played at Whitmore, we're playing on the middle tech, and he's hit the telegraph pole halfway up in the middle of the next field, which is the biggest six I've ever been hit for. And then the next one, he literally just hit me straight over the clubhouse, just ran at me. And I think at that point, then that's when I realised that I needed to be not trying to bowl miracle balls and make him come after me. And I think that was the biggest thing at that point. But I think my first game for him, my second one was at Blythe. But I'm quite sure my first one, I didn't even get a run out because I remember playing that scene. You've got Akko and Sean, I was still playing. So my first game was Hanford away. I'm not quite sure if Mickey Sanders had gone there.
Mickey was there.
Yeah, so Hanford away. If you've ever played at Hanford, it definitely doesn't get above your shins. I think Mickey bowled me, I think, second nut. I've just literally gone back to one that was back with a length and just didn't move. And that was at my point then where I always remember Alan Glover saying to me with his big batting pads he was keeping in, saying, you've got to get forward, Sam. I'm just like, you're joking me, mate. I'm going back here. And then, like I say, it just cleans you up. And it's just, you learn that, you know, you're not just turning up and playing on and things. You've got to turn up and you've got to play the conditions, horses for courses. That's what cricket's about. It's a great leveller. No matter what you say, no matter what you do, it's a great level because there's a million and one different variables. And that's, I suppose, the biggest metaphor in life, really. I think it's just one of those difficult things you've got to come. You've got to understand that there will be highs, there will be lows, there will be risks that you've got to take, some that will pay off. You know, how many times you see a spinner try and, you know, bowl one, you know, toss one up in the air, two out of three will disappear into the sky. Next couple, somebody might run past one or whatever. And how many times you see Sean, for example? I've seen Sean, probably the best duo I ever with Sean was, I was at Leek, he was at Stone, was Sean was bowling probably at the peak of his career, I dare say. Just come back from the RAF, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Running down the hill at Stone. I was opening with Tim Tweets. And I
Reggie at the other end, was it?
Whiffer for the first four overs. But basically, I'm sort of watching Sean give Tim Tweets a bit of a working over. Now, Tim obviously played for Derbyshire for years.
Derby, yeah.
At Stone, traditionally, not thinking, all he was doing was just hitting the seam and getting it to go away. And that was one of the biggest things that I learned at that time there was, like, I've seen Sean bowl a lot worse than that and get a lot of figures. But I remember Sean walking off that day with literally none for nothing and being highly frustrated, but that was probably the best I'd ever seen an upright seam bowler bowl, because it was literally to a point where it was just unplayable. Good line, good length. In a test match, you just said it was a world beater, but didn't really sort of give anything on that particular day, and that's, you know.
But again, I think that's why he was quite clever there, right there, because he came from Meath, which did a little bit as a bowler, and I think he went to Stoke and doing predominantly flat track, so he realised he couldn't rely on sheer pace. He just changed his line, changed how he bowled, and just tied you down really while still doing plenty. So I think that's just a clever bit of cricket, really. But it does help having a team around you who are always talking to you, and that's the great thing about cricket. It's a team game. I mean, some days you don't produce as well as you want to, but you're still part of a team. And that's obviously with any team sport, but yeah.
Well, you learn, don't you? I think that's the biggest thing. You learn, and that, you know, we talk about life lessons, we talk about a whole host of other things, but that's essentially what it is. You learn, and if that's what you're trying to gain from, you've got to learn, and you've got to sort of just, I suppose, get on with it. You know, you realise as you get older that there's a lot more things that are important, and you've just got to sort of adapt to it, really. And I think
honestly, man, I remember my brother. I got lots of them, really. He used to bully me in the back garden for 15 years of my life. With you as well, little housewife. But
take ball.
I played for the dog ball, the shell ball. Yeah. But I played against Port Hill at Stoke. And they had a lad called Matt Hole, I think his name was, a big lad, he used to cane it. Mm-hmm. And I stood back to Sean, he nicked it early on, and I dropped it. And it was absolute dolly. It was ridiculous, mate. I remember Simo at first said to me, "Your brother's going to kill you." And I looked up at him, and he's just giving me the death stare, but didn't say anything. And then I'm thinking, oh God, you can get 150, someone's going to kill me. And then the next ball, he had him out of the W, very next ball. I remember Sean walking down to him, and I went, "Sorry, mate. You went to me, you're shit, but I forgive you." I'm thinking, Christ, mate, that could have been so bad. No. But that's just, it's just how it was, wasn't it, really? It's just good memories we've got.
I'm talking about Port Hill. I remember my second game, the first game got rained off. I remember playing, we drew Port Hill and the Cup away. And then that side, I got up Wedgwood, we got myself, Chrissy Mallard, Greg Wally, we dragged in from the twos.
What side?
Well, you say that, we're playing against Claude Henderson, and we've got Claude Henderson, James Jarvis, Neil Alsmore, I'm trying to think of who it was, but anyway, big Rich Powney. So, Claude Henderson, batting, obviously, played, shed loads of cricket for South Africa, Worcestershire, you name it. This is why cricket's a great leveller, he's literally... We've snicked Claude Henderson off court, third slip, Chrissy Mallard absolutely blinded, and the umpire's gone, "Yeah, no, it's it." I'm like, "You just called it a third slip, how was it not at that?" And then he just stood there like an absolute thing and got 160, and I was like, "Listen, it's just how it is, and you just have to suck it up, or you just deal with it, and it's just how cricket is, really." So it's just one of those things. So, I mean, going back to the original statement we said at the start of the day, it seems, well, what would sort of cricket to sort of look for. So we said obviously good, obviously change room atmosphere, good off the thing. Obviously for the younger ones, we want to make sure that they've got, you know, a little bit of structure, a little bit of drive, a little bit of vision, a little bit of focus. So you've got a young family now. So you've got a youngster. Besides once again to cricket, what are you looking for in a club to sort of when to start grassroots? What we're looking for?
I think I'd look for a club that's got the right infrastructure for coaching, and there's lots of clubs do coaching, but it doesn't mean it's good coaching or right coaching. I think I'd look for someone who does it the right way. I don't mean someone who's actually played the game, but someone who does the right thing with coaching, tells them the right thing. Mm-hmm. I look to have a very positive atmosphere, so hopefully a club that's quite praising. Mm-hmm. You know, the biggest thing I see now is kids not enjoying it and then getting heads down and not being told the right things or being spoken to in the right way. But yeah, I think, especially when they're young, you're in danger of losing what is there to have a good experience. I think, and I think maybe getting a good interaction. I think maybe a smaller clubs are great for that. Like the club we met now, Norton Hills is a a smaller club, you know, it's a village club, you know, Swinnerton, people like that, where they've got more interface with the right people. There's lots of people available that do that. But I think that's what I'm looking for as a parent now. I think that's what I'd be looking for, or as a very young player, where I can get the right help, right advice, I think.
I think where cricket has moved on, I think the safeguarding and the way that people speak to, I mean, I'm not going to name any names, but you think back to, you know, some of the coaching structures we were brought up in,
yeah.
It was very much
yeah.
a case of, I think some people get strung up the way they speak to some people and different things. But I think you're quite right there in terms of the structure of cricket is very, very important. Even though it's a team game, obviously there's a lot of individual element to it. And I think, you know, as long as there's a good family atmosphere, a great place, more importantly, for the mums to enjoy and
yeah.
settle, because they're going to spend a lot of time there, and obviously for a good environment. But like I say, from a youngster's point of view, you want them to have, yes, I think it's education, isn't it? You want
yes.
you want people
yeah.
to, you want role models, you want people to learn from, you want, yes, they want pushy because it's ambition, it's that sort of stuff, but at the same time, it's got to be, it's just positive reinforcement. Anything that you would ever say to an individual about being educated, it's got to be quite right. And I think what you were saying up there from a cricket point of view, and get your opinion on this, was cricket is very much a social enhancement point of view. I know, like, when we've obviously had conversations previously, and I know obviously in your line of work and things like that, you meet people who you then build relationships in outside
yeah.
of cricket, whether that be business relationships, social relationships,
yeah.
that sort of stuff. And it is very much that sort of ilk, really. And if you've got a club that can provide you with those options and being around those types of people, because you see a lot of people saying you've got to surround yourself with the right people doing the right things at the right time, you've got to make sure that your club is the right people for that at that time
yes.
as well. Yeah, you're in full agreement with that?
You broke up. I'm in very much full agreement, mate. I think that's spot on there, really. I don't know what I say there, mate. I think you hit the nail right on the head. As soon as a young player or a young man with a family, that's exactly everything you're looking for, really. Yeah, can't say anything better there.
I might say, people might think that we stood here saying that, oh, you know, you've got to go to a club that, you know, they've got solicitors, lawyers, doctors, accountants. That's not really the case. You look at some of the role models that you grew up around. Steve Atkinson. Not necessarily always got everything right, but if you look at a role model of what is right and wrong, what is a good word,
a good moral compass, I think, isn't it? Yeah,
exactly.
Good moral compass.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
and I'm not saying you have to be so PC now where you have to say everything right all the time. I'm all in favour. If someone's done something wrong or not doing something the right way, then you address it. But I do think, that, like you said, positive reinforcement is such a big thing nowadays for children, that they've got to keep doing it, really, because you'll lose them.
Well, yeah, isn't that, I think that's the key thing, and it's got to be varied, it's got to be diverse, like, you know, and we had this chat again with Longy, and he was saying that he's recognised a trend. He thinks the conversion between young, mid to late teens going into the early 20s playing cricket seems to have massively drifted
Forward.
Away. From time, having spoken to a friend of mine who's just got into managing a local Sunday League football team, he's saying it's just getting the general commitment out of anybody. You know, you get 4 or 5 people just randomly don't turn up on a Sunday just because that's how they just don't feel about it. And is that just the fact that it's okay just to send a text to say you're not coming anymore? I mean, I remember playing under 18s. I mean, we all used to turn up for oatcakes. But
yeah,
it used to be Sunday morning, it doesn't matter what hangover you got. I mean, I'll point out it was different times back in the day. We were saying under 18s and everybody's sitting at the hangover, but it was one of those things that you just turned up because you couldn't just send a text message. You couldn't just let somebody down, or you couldn't ring, you know, your manager, because the manager couldn't pick up the landline because he's at the club. And I think it's just one of those things. I sound really fuddy duddy now. I'm like 37, and it's like,
no, it's not, it's a sign of the times. But I remember if we did that still to send the text to those days, I'd have been absolutely caned if I'd have done that, or we'd have done that. You'd never play cricket again, really, doing that. But it's a common thing, isn't it? You send a text, sometimes you don't even send a text, they just don't show up. Yeah, it is.
And people just expect it to be dealt with because there's no sort of fear of recompense and thing. And it does leave people sort of in the lurch, really. And I think it's difficult. And again, it comes back to those volunteers of clubs, those volunteers that make cricket what it is, really, because the clubs wouldn't exist without them. And I think that's the most important thing. And if anybody's looking for a club or looking for a move, I'm just going to, I'm really, really, really need to sit at the bathroom. So I'm going to call this part one of the podcast and I'll come back to you in 2 seconds for part 2.
All right, mate. No.
Welcome back to part 2 of episode 4. I've been joined by lifelong friend and former teammate and rival Andy Bowers. And we're talking what players might look for in a club and what clubs should be looking to offer if they're looking to maximise their sort of playing membership and different aspects of that. And one of the interesting parts that I wanted to cover in part 2 was a very interesting conversation that pops up every now and again about clubs often moan about loyalty amongst players and different things like that, especially into the season we come after Christmas and New Year, moving into the transfer deadline in February, about players moving and different things. And the argument could be, is that a lack of player loyalty, or is it a situation where it's a two-way street where players can sometimes be left out in the cold due to a club's ambition and sort of transfer activities and different things like that. So I'll give you an example here, Andy. I remember, in fact, I'll make it personal, I'll go with myself, really. I remember growing up as a young lad and being offered over the closed winter that the next season would be my chance to sort of stake a claim to the first team, because there was a bowling spot up for grabs, blah, 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 blah. And then literally the week before the deadline came in, rightly, obviously a great player, went on to play for staff. Lokes and brought in Dave Edwards and Mick Lewis, Australian international bowler.
Mad Mick.
Yeah, Mad Mick. Rapid, but definitely mad. And that kind of pushed my nose out the door, really. So I've always had that argument, as much as I'm not looking to enforce it or reinforce it. It is that sort of two-way street that, you know, clubs, there are certain amounts of slots and availability. And with cricket being an individualistic game, batting, bowling being one of the key things, separates it, I suppose, from football and rugby, as it's kind of what people want to turn up and play for. You know, as a young person, you're trying to grow up, you want to bowl as many overs as you can, you want a prime batting slot so you can have a chance to prove yourself. I mean, what's your thoughts on that? What's the most important, player loyalty or club loyalty?
I think, I think it's a bit of both. As a player, I think you've got to be good enough. Mm-hmm. For it, so you know what Longton did to you. Mm-hmm. That's harsh, low. That is low, especially when you've been promised something. Mm-hmm. And you haven't even got long to sort out. You know, you've got a week before the start of the season. As well as, yes, they have made some good signings. They've also made news conversations with yourself where they promise you something and they're not delivered. Mm-hmm. Now, really, I think player loyalty is quite divisive. I think the club's got to offer you something as well. I don't mean money. I mean social events. Thing, a place to go for your family, you know, if you've got a family and things like that. And in return, as a player, you give your all and you have that team perform, really. I think it's a real 50-50, that one. And like you say, it is divisive. I don't think it's a straight line with that one, really.
I think the key thing is context, really. I think every case has got to have a little bit of context in it. I think, I suppose it comes back to sort of every aspect of life. There's always two sides to every story. And one of the biggest things I've noticed is growing up, when you know you see players move and things like, people go, "Oh, that's happened for money," or "This has happened for that," and you forget that cricket very much is a social situation. And if obviously there's friction within clubs or things change, you know, obviously somebody brings in a new captain, they want to bring in an overseas, or you know, somebody's become available that is a chance to do that. And because it is competitive and clubs want to compete, people want to be successful, you know, chairmen and captains and people like that are put in position to try and make the club be as successful as possibly can. And I think one of the biggest things that needs to be taken into consideration is, you know, I think it comes back to anything, just general communication. I think that's the thing. There's always going to be change. Clubs are always looking to adapt and move forward. But you know, there's always only ever going to be four or five bowling slots on a Saturday, and, you know, the top seven batting spaces are there for there.
And, you know, clubs will always look to improve. You know, by nature, they will do that. It's the human ways that we try to get better all the time. You know, I fully get that. But you just mentioned there about players moving for money. On a personal level, I remember when I went from Aldridge to Stone, that was 2007. Now, I travelled from Walsall to Stone every week, and I never thought about asking for money. I did it to try and better yourself and to play the high standards you can while I still could. Mm-hmm. I played with my brother a little bit, you know, and I wouldn't expect Stone to offer me any type of guarantee, really. And I think, like you say, communication is key. You know, you're honest with them. You hope the club are honest with you, and hopefully you meet somewhere in the middle, really. I remember at Aldridge, there's a guy who considered probably my best friend called Matt Higgins. Now, Matt Higgins, I'm a firm believer, would have walked, if he played North Staffordshire, he'd have walked into the Staffordshire side. He was an incredible cricketer. He'd get me out with an orange, that kid. He got, you know, got double 100. He averaged about 3 with the ball, you know, 500-600 wickets. But his club froze him out because he reached 40. And on the other side of the coin, you think, well, the club should have a bit of loyalty there to him for everything he's done for that club over the years, just to, from the outside looking in, discarded him because he reached a certain age. Yeah. I thought was wrong. I think that's where clubs can do things better, you know, communicate better with them, tell them why, give them a reason why, explain where you're going to go, what you're thinking is really. I feel your point, really. Yeah, it's a two-way thing, and clubs and players have both got to be honest.
Well, same thing, you know, people like clubs will over years probably built teams around Matt in that situation, and
yeah,
I suppose it just comes down to, like, say if a tact is being changed, then that's just sort of how it's got to be. It's just, but it's who you're sitting down, you know. If Matt's in that situation, he needs to be considered as a key, he's a stakeholder at the end of the day, which people get confused with the term stakeholder. People think stakeholder means they've got, you know, some sort of money involved in that. It's not. It's a stakeholder in any part, whether it be a business, a club. It could be anything from the people who own the houses around the outside of the ground, because you're going to hit the ball into their windows. The people who walk past. It could be the general community, the businesses that it serves, the players, the patrons, the vice presidents, the mums, the dads, nans, the grands, the buckets of Vindaloo. All those people involved are all stakeholders within the club. And those people need to be essentially not consulted, because sometimes you don't need to give all the information out. But in that situation, contextualised, you can't just turn around to somebody who's been a good servant and everything and say, look, we're freezing you out. It's just like, hi, mate, how are you feeling? What's the thing? This is where we're looking to go.
Exactly. It's just a conversation, isn't it? An honest conversation, really.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. And I think what would be interesting to see over the next 8 to 9 weeks will be see how many transfers happen. A, because clubs have progressed in a certain way and people have been frozen out, or whether or not there's something socially behind the scenes, you know, where we always used to laugh about if anything's happened at the end of the season, cricket do, who's sort of flirted with such and such his mum or daughter, and then they've been...
Of course.
I can, I'm not going to name any names, but I can count at least 5 occasions where that's happened, so... That's just club cricket.
You go back to stakeholders again, you look at your own club now, I mean, from the outside looking in, listen to your podcast, Simon Belfield, you know, stakeholder, Fernival, stakeholder, yourself, Mike, stakeholders, really. You just, if something happened to any of those, you just hope it's done the right way, really. You know, I understand clubs progress, and I get that. But, you know, clubs also owe respect. I think it's respect, isn't it? Both ways, really. You just hope that's what happened.
Well, again, it's just happened. It depends on which way. I'm trying to think what I've not played properly. I think the last full season I had was 2013 at Barlaston, and the season before that, you know, I was playing.
Did you move this way or that way?
To Norfolk. This is the biggest thing. In 2012, I was out in the bowling for Swarderson, who won the East Anglian Premier League that year, and were live on Sky Sports winning the National Club Knockouts. And then they were back then this year. So we were top clubs out in East Anglia. I moved back to Barlaston, and all that had sort of, you know, we'd gone into a situation where we got Tom Taylor, we got Zaffa, we got, I think it was almost sort of discarded, really. And it kind of, I didn't really mind at that point. I think one of the biggest things that you know, again from a communication, and I'm good friends with Mark, was Mark had got so many people at his disposal. And I was really keen to bowl. I mean, I'm 37 now, would have been at the time 34. Not many years left to run in and bowl at peak, and I'd worked really hard to be fit at that point. And it was just disappointing to just be told that, you know, I wouldn't be required for my bowling services at all, and that left me, you know, frustrated because my batting skills have always been limited. But it's just always been a situation, you know, as a hard competitor. I think that's kind of where the love for the game fell out of it, really. I really wanted to make sure that I was at the peak of my powers. And, you know, it's fair play to Norton. You know, I bowl every now and again the cup, but for me, I'm just happy to sort of, I just want to have a role and want to be able to do that. The competitiveness army means I just want to have a role and have the ability to play my role in the team, whether that be at the top of the order, you know, fudging a few, or whether that's whatever, you know, it's just one of
the. But you're still a competitor, that's a competitor in you, isn't it? No matter what you're doing or what standard you're playing, you're still a competitor.
Yeah, you just want to have a role. Whatever that role is, you want to be able to have your role, and you want to have the structure to be able to do that the best of your ability.
See, I haven't got that anymore. I have to play cricket happily, not bat or bowl. Quite happily not do that. I've lost all love for that. I do it, and now one for the camaraderie, and two, my role as a skipper of the side. Good or badly, that's my role. But you, everyone's different, aren't you? You still got that fire to roll, to do something, to have something, to bat, bowl, captain, field, or whatever that may be. You still have that role inside you.
Yeah, I think that's the same thing. Everybody wants to have a role, and I suppose that's a challenge as a captain. So you're saying you're happy not batting or bowling, but your role is just equally important, keeping those 11 cricketers happy to the best of your ability, and also making conscious decisions. I mean, I haven't captained since 2005, and you know, I don't think I'd ever want to do it again, because it's going to be the most unselfish things that you can try and do. I look at what Mike's done. Obviously, he's, you know, he signed for Norton, was batting in the top order. He bats himself 10 and 11 every week because obviously he knows he's got a plethora of all-rounders that he needs to keep happy.
And remember when I signed Mark for Aldridge Benders for a season?
Yeah.
He gave me the most almighty caning. And he generally said, why are you batting 11 and not keeping wicket? I was like, one, I don't want to. And two, you're babysitting 10 other people.
Yeah.
And it's easier for me to keep them happy than yourself happy.
Yeah.
And that's just what I found, really.
I don't think you're ever going to keep everybody happy. I found out a long, long time ago, especially when I was captain at all stages, that you can't keep everybody happy. The one time you try and keep everybody happy, that's the one time you'll make everybody unhappy. And what you're going to try and do is work out who, because, you know, there's loads of characters that, you know, have got misguided ideas of what they want and where they should be. And ultimately, when you're entrusted with that job as captain, you've got to do what you feel is right at the time. Yes, there's going to be everybody else's different perspectives and line of view, but you do what is right in what you perceive to be right, and you've got to do what is right for that. And it's difficult as well, especially with small clubs, because you've got small player pools and everybody wants to bat and bowl and all that sort of stuff. So it does get fairly difficult, and it does go in an opposite direction, really, where it's difficult to manage. You know, I think I see so many clubs lose players because of it, and I know they then get upset because they may have spent a lot of time investing their time, effort and coaching and things like that. But ultimately, people want to play first in cricket, and if there's, you know, only 11 players and you've got, you know, 22 juniors coming through your system every 12, 18 months, then,
of course,
you know, you're going to lose them elsewhere. And you look at the clubs like Longton, Stone, Port Hill, that have just been, I suppose, they've brought through so many cricketers that go off and play sort of elsewhere. Hemmies are getting into that situation now. They have such a...
Yeah, I think that's why your point is key, really, because you get, you know, the loyalty in club, you know, club and player. Ultimately, both club and player are giving time. Time's the biggest thing we've got, really. So you just want to use it in the right way, don't you? People want to get a fair crack, and the clubs want to give you a fair crack, but also want to win things sometimes. It's a trade-off, isn't it?
Yeah, okay, cool. Right, moving on to the last 2 points then. We wanted to go from the outside looking in. Honest as you and candid as you normally are, give me your overall assessment of Norton over the last 2 years from the outside looking in.
Well, I've actually, believe it or not, even though I moved away a long time ago, I still, you know, I follow most of the North Staffs clubs, you know, it's a motherland, isn't it, really?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember the title winning side 2002. I was at Fenton now. I remember some of the great players we had, like Longy, Andy Kenbeam, I think, maybe Neil Blore was there, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and it always seemed to be a village club that was trying their hardest to improve, really. Obviously, you won the Premier League, for God's sake. It was an incredible achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And then you did go down, you know, for the rules were rightly and wrongly, you know, the pyramid system came in and the infrastructure wasn't right. I get that. But I think that the strides you've made in the last 2 years is staggering, really. From like, you know, you went from the Stone League, essentially, working back up again. You didn't appear to have a lot of money from the outside looking in. You were basically building a club from scratch again, weren't you, really? Because look where you are now. The standard you're playing, the people you've got, you always appear to have a good atmosphere, the camaraderie seems to be there. And people I speak to now really enjoy playing there like I did. They always find it a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the wicket's always going to be a challenge, like any wicket sometimes is a challenge, but in a good way. And I just think it's one of those places where you go and you have a pint at the end of the game, you socialise. I think that's the biggest compliment I can give you, really. You just build a club from scratch, you know, and you mark a lot, you know. Custodians of that, really.
I think the biggest thing that I could always say is, like, what people don't realise is we probably, even, I would dare say, best in the top three divisions, probably the smallest budget. You know, we would massively love to go and have, you know, a genuine overseas professional.
I remember you had a pro a couple years ago that we looked to sign. A guy called Zach, I think his name's an Aussie.
Zach Home.
I won't mention anymore. But if you look at Zach, but you know, in the past you had him to here. Now that's no slight on Zach at all.
Yeah.
But look, you know, where you've been to where you were and now where you are. Staggering, mate. Phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah, I think, really. I'm saying we don't mention Zach. He's still he's a club legend. He's a man. The figure, he's a Norton legend rather than a Norton Hills Cricket Club legend. He's just mad as a box of frogs, mate. And I know for a fact he was listening because he subscribes to the podcast. So, so I think it's one of those things where it's just trying to do it the right way, you know. And I know there's a lot of clubs that are trying to forge their way in their own. Everybody's got their own strategy. Everybody's got their way of different doing it. And you just have to do it in the right way. You mentioned that. The league rules are the league rules, and we, you know, back in the early 2000s fell victim to that, and it's happened again recently. You know, we finished third in Div 2 with 1 point from going up to Div 1, and then obviously got relegated back to Div 3, which is obviously, I think Mike described it as a blessing in disguise at the time, just give us an option to sort of re-galvanise. You know, for the first time in years, Norton will have two junior teams this year with the option to add maybe one or two more in there before the start of the season due to, you know,
and let's face it, two junior teams for a village the size of Norton is good going, really, and that's no sign anyway, it's a good going, isn't it? Because all the clubs around you as well, and the big draw, it's great achievement.
Well, it is, yeah, and I think it's just one of those things, you know, the catchment area that we pull from is difficult, and it's just one of those things, and I think the ethos that the club are trying to do is to do it the right way. And I can't thank sort of Roland Tavern, who's the club chairman at the minute. He's put this 5-year vision in, which obviously is to be confidential and remain within his vision. But it's one of those things that it's just clear. And the big message behind it is he wants the club to thrive, really, because, you know, I think me and Bales were talking about last week, it is pretty much one of the nicest places to play now. It hasn't always been that. Obviously, when it was the old wooden hut, I remember playing there, and with the porter cabinet, it was horrible. But with the time and effort that they've put into, you know, the nice areas
around it. I played there when it's porter cabins and stuff, and one wooden shack. But I found I still had lots of character even in those times, really. It was a nice place to go, wasn't it? I enjoyed you there.
Yeah, I'm probably being a bit of a cricket club snobby. I mean, I've grown up once where you had great facilities. It's really nice now where you can actually have a shower in a nice environment and actually sit in a really nice bar. There's some nice sofas and different things like that, because that's where you want to spend your time, you know, and it's fair play to the team behind the scenes that have made that happen. And generally, the events that they have at the club are second to none, really. And again, that comes down to the characters and the stakeholders behind the scenes, really. And obviously, the partnership they've got with Jowls is it's yeah. massively, you know, the relationship between any brewery and a cricket club is one that should, it's almost as important as marriage, really. So it's got to be a good relationship that works. The beer's got to be good, and obviously the people that are drinking it have got to be willing participants, really. And I think that's the way forward. And right, I can't let you go without obviously touching on, obviously we talk about cricket being a life lesson and different things like that, and obviously I just wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking and paying sort of homage and sort of a bit of a testimonial to your old man. I stated at the time when I found out the news of his passing that at times he was probably a father figure to me, and he's helped me in more ways than anybody I've ever come across. Obviously, how long has it been now since
the... down 27th of September.
27th of September. So
on holiday in Cornwall.
And how's things with you? How have you adapted?
As you know, you've lost, sadly, very sadly, you've lost a parent, you know. Mm-hmm. I meant like you, my old man for you, you're older, you're clear with an amazing lady, so you know, you've gone through the same as me. You know, you get good days and bad days. Today's a good day. you just wake up, go to bed, and hope that tomorrow's a good day as well. But you know, it's a kick in the teeth, isn't it, when it comes from nowhere, really. When I was growing up, my old man was he was Mr. Henny for me, and I spent a lot of time with Henny. And he still is my hero, and I absolutely devastated on it. I know Sean is the same, my mother's the same, and I thought his funeral was testament to him that how many people came here. He's just an incredible, sweet man, and I'll miss him forever, really.
I know it's one of those things. I've got some good stories about him from cricket. He was the amount of times he's picked me up off Trenton Road when I've been in an absolute drunken mess or whatever in my younger years, you know, wiped away tears and different things like that through a bit of a difficult childhood at times. But I think one of the biggest things that stood out for me was his very, very dry sense of humour. He was one of the funniest men I've ever met. And I always remember he probably got about 10 jokes that were all pretty much the same.
Yeah,
like,
on loop. Yeah.
It's like, oh, he's a dark horse.
Yeah.
Black Beauty. And I'm like, yeah, cheers. Or, Simon, just can't get over it. What? 10-foot walls. Like,
he had me
that last week, you know.
Yeah. He's a bit lost, isn't he? Who, Robinson Crusoe? That's the one, yeah. He was just an incredibly sweet man, really. He had time for everyone, and his whole gentle demeanour, and he was just an open man. But he was also the village idiot. I mean, I remember going, he went to the man's face in Trenton, and he called my mum to pick him up because he went in the bar and came out of the lounge and didn't know where he was and got lost. I mean, he lives about half a mile away, really. I mean, he just went out a different door. But it's sometimes thinking, well, God, Dad, you're okay, man. But yeah, he's just incredible human being, really. I'll miss him forever.
Yeah, and like I say, it's just one of those, we spoke about volunteers in the game, and you think about the amount of time and effort and love and care he put into not only Hemis. I remember for a brief period, did he go and do the work at Eccleshall as well?
He did the ground at Eccleshall, he did the ground at Redgate. Obviously, he did Hemis for a long, long time. I mean, the wicket at Hemis, even on the Working Men's Club, was incredible. And then when they moved to the new ground, you know, it's new ground, it was tested. But even then, I remember him 2 weeks before the season started on the first game at the new Hemis ground, where he was rolling the pitch and the rolls of turf were folding up with the roller. And somehow he managed to get a wicket, didn't play that bad. But he used to spend, I'm not, no exaggeration, 14, 15 hours a day there with Cheryl, his dog. Mm. And, you know, my mum was looking at the house and we loved it because he was with us all the time. But the amount of hours he spent at these places was just phenomenal. And he never got a penny. He never would really ask for a penny or want a penny. But those kind of volunteers are the things that clubs are made on, really, as you said earlier.
Yeah, I've just well there, and obviously, like I say, it was good to see you at the funeral. And like I say, massive. I think they say is a measure of the man is how many people turn up to say goodbye. And if I have half the amount of people that were there at your old man's turnout, I'll be a very, very happy man. So,
well, I think that's what we can hope for. You know, I've got two kids. Sean's got, you know, Josh, he's 19 now, nearly, and I just feel sorry for them more because life has robbed them of a. One of the most amazing men I've ever met.
Yeah, great, great model, great role model, mate. And I say generally, and heart feel for you, and wish you sort of all the best, and obviously with the family on it, really. So, and like I say, it's one of those things. We talk about cricket being great life lessons and things like that. Is, you know, when people are moaning and groaning on a Saturday about, you know, did they get a shocking decision, or did they get one that kept low, or, you know, is the track a shit tip? Is it this? Blah blah blah. At the end of the day, just smile. You've got to work Monday, and just thankful for the loved ones that you've got around you, and make sure that you're happy and smiling around them, because, like I say, you never know when you might not get that opportunity again. So,
Cool. Can I ask you a question before you're in the line?
Yeah, go on.
It's a question I asked my brother. I was going to ask my brothers as well. Just talk about, you know, overseas pros and stuff.
Yeah.
Who was probably the greatest one top ever you played with or against?
Oh, hang on. I've got rid of this feature. Is this mean you're game for answer the questions? Because everybody else is shooting. All right, I'll answer my own question. Greatest overseas pro I've ever played with.
With and against. Do both.
With. Purely for... he probably got the best out of me and probably everybody in the team. I would probably say Vassbert Drakes. Probably.
Yeah,
he probably gave... was the one person that gave me the confidence with a cricket bat, because I'd always... struggled, always been pushed into being a bowler, but he gave me so much confidence, and he also brought my bowling on no end. You know, especially bowling on flat ones at Leek, that was really, really prominent from that. And I think probably the one that I played against, best one, probably not from his time that he had at Nantwich, a gentleman by the name of Glenn Battisciato. I played against him when we were out at Swordeston. About 6'4", big, massive Queenslander, bullied the cricket ball, and bowled, not at lightning pace, but bowled at a point where he would literally have an influence with the bat or the ball. And I'm not talking your pinch hit, your 30, 40, 50 quick style. He would score big, big hundreds. He would probably, you know, he was the master of bouncer yorker. If you were trying to defend for a draw, he would be going bouncers, yorkers, trying to go that. So I think from that point on there. So, all right, since on that one, I'll ask you the same question.
Well, I'm glad you have to say it, because I judge everything he's played with, not just on stats, but on what he did for the club. Really, you know, I played with people like Amir Ozzie, incredible cricketer, Reggie Mosey, stats speak for himself. But probably the best of that from Aldridge called Andy Wiley, who was, he played for South Africa A, and he was at Aldridge, I think, for 10 years. I think he's coaching Matthew's University now. I think he's coaching the first class side. His weight of runs was just solid, but he just gave you this confidence. And I found he pushed you on to be better, to improve yourself, whether it's runs, how you act, how you are around your teammates, things like that. I just find that an interesting question, because I judge it not just on stats, really, but I think Wiles is probably the best one to play with. And against is a long list, but just on pure... Well, I think Barrington's up there. Barrington Brown was incredible, wasn't he?
I played against Barrington, and actually got a decent friendship relationship when he was at Nantwich playing in the Cause Cup and a few of the 2020s that we played, and I think purely down to the friendship and the fact he was probably in his mid-50s was the only reason I'd had the confidence to run down the track and hit into extra cover. But I think just from that point, I think again, it comes back from context in terms of, like...
Yes, it does. There's so many of them, Mornay, Alfonso, T.P. Keith Semple, so many of them.
How many
of them? Andy Tweed, Longton, there's so many of them.
We always used to mention when we were growing up, that word, the cutter, the thing that, like Sean's favourite word, your cutter, the thing that got you going, that got your intensity.
Your arse is going, yeah.
That one, what was making you... It wasn't necessarily like, you know, I played against Reggie and Immy, where you know you're angling for your life and you've got two ways of going about it. You're taking some chances or you're not. Whereas I've always been brought up at Clayton and Longton. We used to have a players' game at Longton where they would literally get a wet, incredible... And you would have, the only thing you would have would be a box and a cricket stump, and they would run and throw it at you 15 yards. Yeah, and you would let it, that was your style. Depends if it hit you on the hand, it hit you, it hurt, it slapped. Obviously, it wouldn't break a bone or whatever. But that for me always helped me out with seam bowling and things like that, especially on quick bounce decks. I never really felt for the whole, you know, the quickies. But I think the biggest thing for me was, you know, people who would generally want to challenge and you want to try and aspire to be better against, you know. And I think it's one of them that...
I think Jed Bryant's on the quickest one I've faced. I think he's one of the best. He was incredible. He didn't give anything to it. Yeah, I say it's quick. The morning was sharp, and Sebi Ahmed and Arthur Fazel were plenty. But I think the pure ability and pure, you know, testing you as a player was, I think Barrington was probably up there for me.
I think it comes back to attitude. You talk about that game we played against Keith Afton at the time. He was a full international West Indian cricketer. Turned up 50 minutes before the game started, and as soon as he got out, which I'll point out was in the second over of the game, he might have been with 260, but Sean cleaned him up in the next over.
Sean rolled him up, didn't he? Yeah, rocked him up, yeah.
10 minutes later, he's in the car, gone home. Now
he's gone, and I thought he got £300 for that as well. At the time, it's phenomenal money.
Yeah, and I think you look at what does a club like Whitmore get out of that? There's no... He's passed on no stories, he's threw his hat around, he's done whatever. And I say that, I actually saw him play at Little Stoke the season before against Longton, and he had a decent game. And you've got to look at from where clubs are paying out money, and I think this is where a lot of the money goes in coaching. I look at people like Matt Coakley and people like that at Port Hill, where... You know, the clubs are paying them good money, but they're actually doing a really good job at sort of bringing on the juniors. And you've got to look at where does your money go and what does it...
Which is why I asked the question, because I don't get judging overseas on stats. I'm judging on what they give you as a club. That's why I question you.
Well, the one that really drags me out, and people haven't really answered for, because I think it's a bit of a taboo... I don't really. I'll name it. I don't really care. But since the league has changed, obviously you had an influx of sort of paid cricketers. I know there was a lot of bit of talking before it went open about boot money and brown envelopes and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
We won't even get into that. We're in the year of when it's opened up and stuff. Who's the best paid clubby cricketer that you played with? People who, you know, you're getting paid, but they're giving you a good return for the money.
I've never played at a club where we paid more than one. So Alders, you only paid one. Wickington, now we only pay one. And then Meath, we only paid a million and stuff. But I think when I played against him, for Stone, Gaz Morris was obviously getting something, wasn't he? But I think, you know, Gaz is my cousin, so I have to say it. But he was incredible, Gaz was.
Yeah.
He did a lot of coaching, guys. He was there for the kids. He spent time on the Friday nights. He's probably the toughest guy in doing something bad.
Well, yeah, definitely. I think the big one for that is, like, say, what you're getting. You want people who are going to have an effect to the game. You want people who, if you think about it, you go back generations, people, somebody like Andy Kempin, it was more of an investment getting in play for you, because wherever you paid him, you put 10 times more behind the bar.
Behind the bar,
you've got to speculate to accumulate. And I think the biggest thing that I've spotted thing is, like, I think that's where the thing is, people who are getting money that won't put anything back into it. And I think that probably the best paid cricketer locally that I've played with, best paid.
Bengers, maybe. Bengers might be up there. He's, you know, he, love him or loathe him, his ability was second to none, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's a
camera. He didn't give anything back, granted. He didn't give anything back for money.
But I think, thinking about it, I always said Richard Sims when I was at Swordeston, he was cricket master at Norwich School, Zimbabwe green guy. But the amount of coaching and wisdom that he passed on, like, we were playing serious games of cricket, and this guy would just be the most calming influencer than on anybody I'd ever come across. You know, he was bona fide English resident at that point, and just so calm. You know, you've got 70 to win off sort of 8 overs, and Simsy's just walking around saying, "Yeah, mate, yeah, Sal, just punch a couple through the covers, we'll get these," and just little sort of calming things like that. And it wasn't just me you'd have an effect on. You'd have that effect on Mark, the captain, whether it be George, all the people around. It's just having that sort of thing. And I think these are the characters that clubs need to sort of have around. If they're bringing on the better talent, they've got the experience, they can pass the stories on. I think that's the way forward it will come, because those are the people that will bring people through the door. They're those people that will keep people, and they're the people that will look after your juniors and give you that focus and that direction. And not all clubs have got that, you know, and the ones that do have that focus and that direction do seem to be the ones that seem to have those characters in their ranks, really.
Yeah, I think one quote, well, he's never got paid to play cricket, but probably the one in my own family, my brother's been there. He's certainly one who's given a lot back anyway, and he's decent cricket, you know. So, with respect to him, he's recently retired, you know, he's got over 500 wickets.
Again, he'll be back.
Respect to him. He won't, mate. He's sold his dodgy.
I remember when after I'd, I'm trying to think, maybe 3 years ago at Hemheath, I've only played actually one game at the new ground. With moving away and stuff, and I played against him, and again he captained that game, and there were some characters in that team for Hemheath that year, and Sean just added a little bit of element of class to it, really. I think that was not from a technique point of view, just the things that we're saying and things like that. And I think it's just one of those things that, you know, you just need to have those people in there that you can just put a shoulder around somebody and say, mate, there's no need for that, you just need to go in this direction and things like that. And it's those little life mentors that people want, really. And again, what Longy was saying a couple weeks ago, in terms of it's nice when he's playing in Div 2, Div 3, playing against people who, you know, you've had fierce battles against at the higher standard 10, 15 years ago.
Longy, by definition, mate, what a cricketer and what a man, Longy. One of the nicest men I wish to meet. You know, thousands of runs locally, but you'd never... He never put you down your throat, did he? You know, one of the nicest men you wish to meet, Longy. You know, how you play cricket, it should be played.
Yeah, and he's one of those people, you know, I mean, growing up, like, you come across loads of people that have always tried to knock him behind closed doors, but that's purely because he's one of those people that you don't want to play against because he's a fierce competitor. And obviously, was never really at a much fancied club, you know, and he's, you know, I think it's just one of those things, and I think that's, Longy's one of those people I've learned a lot of lessons about, sort of, perspective and context from, really. And I think that's just one of those things that it's just nice to sort of get on with and move forward with, really. So okay, cool. Well, it's coming to the end of episode 4. I want to thank you very much for being my guest, Andy. Great to get a perspective from the outside in. Great to hear that the family doing well. Obviously, send you my dearest and deepest thoughts regarding your old man, and obviously at some point I'm sure I'll share a beer with you to celebrate him, and if you send your best to your family, who knows if Whittington, if you can fancy it, maybe get you a pre-season friend, then you can come try some Green Monkeys and stuff. Litchfield's not a million miles away. So thank you very much for listening to episode 4 of the podcast. Again, if you've liked what it is that we're doing, if you've liked what you're listening to, I've received so many messages of congratulations and queries and a little bit of banter and repartee that we have. If you enjoy it, please like, share, tell somebody else about it, comment on the social media channels. We definitely want to be part of it. And then stay tuned for next week, where we'll go through our Christmas itinerary and also moving through and unleashing some of our very special guests. So thank you very much for listening. See you next week.